Yeah.
Right. Looking good. It looks like we have a connection of everyone who is necessary for the first argument. So the marshal may call us to order, please.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Hooten, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is January 12, 2021. This panel of the court had five cases on its calendar today. One was dismissed voluntarily. That leaves four. Two will be submitted by oral argument. Two will be submitted without oral argument, solely on the briefs. The first case set for oral argument today is number A20-976. It's captioned as Foster and Others versus Minnesota Department of Corrections and Others. It looks like both counsel are prepared. I believe you know the general rules. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. If you have the right settings about the view, you will be able to see the time clock. So counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and begin.
Good morning, Your Honor. Dan Shulman on behalf of the petitioners. May it please the court. I would like to talk about three issues this morning. The first is the right of the petitioners to an evidentiary hearing, or in the words of the statute, a trial. The second is the pending motion for judicial notice of the information contained on the DOC's COVID updates page. And the third is the power of the court to issue a writ of mandamus in these proceedings. So
Mr. Shulman, before you begin with those arguments, you omitted any mention of what I was thinking was the primary issue, and that is your petition for habeas corpus and the appropriate source of law and legal standard. Are you simply resting on your brief on that issue?
No, I'm prepared to address that issue as well. And since Your Honor raised that, I'll start with it. It's an issue of law, and the question is whether when challenging conditions of confinement, habeas corpus is appropriate under Minnesota law only on a showing of cruel and unusual punishment, which requires deliberate indifference to the plight of the prisoners, which includes knowledge that there is a threat to health or life and safety, which I don't think is disputed here. And then deliberate disregard of that, failure to do anything, conscious failure to do anything. First of all, we don't think that's the appropriate standard because there is no Minnesota case that says that. It's a creation of federal law. And second, the Minnesota decisions, and we have cited them, I think it's at page 31 of our brief, say essentially that habeas corpus is available for violations of constitutional rights. And then it goes on, and some of the cases say in violation of statutes and other, and as well as conditions, essentially any, our position is that it's any violation of a duty.
I'd like to ask you so then more specifically about your reference to the Minnesota Constitution and the Minnesota statutes. So if you were permitted to prevail in a habeas claim based upon cruel or unusual punishment, how would your argument be different than it is otherwise?
The Minnesota Supreme Court has said that it's more that there is a difference. There's an obvious difference. It's a material difference. and the Minnesota statute is more lenient. We think in this particular case, the Minnesota Constitution is a more lenient standard. We think in this, and the difference is significant, we think in this particular case, certainly there is actual knowledge of a threat.
I would agree being disjunctive, not conjunctive, is easier for a petitioner to establish. But which is it? Is it cruel or is it unusual? I mean, which is your best argument there?
Well, if I have to choose,
I'm not sure if I spoke correctly. I meant to say, is it cruel or is it unusual?
Well, it's probably both, but I think unusual is the more lenient, would be the more lenient. I believe we satisfy both because there is actual knowledge of the threat. More than that, there is actual knowledge of what needs to be done to combat the threat. And then third, there is evidence that it's not being done. Which again brings me back to the first issue, which is the right to a hearing.
Mr. Shulman, can I ask you to follow up on that? It strikes me from review of the habeas statute and the case law, both state and federal refers to punishment, and you are using the phrase, which we have seen in some of the cases, conditions. How does that, whether we're using the state constitution, the federal constitution, or can you tell me, point me to any particular case that referred to something other than the incarceration, the punishment, the term, the appropriateness of being in prison, to what's alleged here, which is a virus? In other words, there's no question that I don't believe that the petitioners are appropriately imprisoned. And so you're referring to cruel and unusual punishment, and yet it's a health issue. And I didn't see any cases that referred to conditions related to health.
Well, in effect, there are cases that refer to assaults. The punishment that they're assigned, that they're sentenced to, is a term in prison. This, in effect, is an additional punishment. It's as if they had a beating from the guards because the correction officers, the staff, is undoubtedly a source of infection. This is something that is avoidable, preventable, treatable, and yet they are being subjected to it. I submit that that is a form of punishment.
Is it true? Can I just clarify, though, that the only basis with regard to a virus arguably might be the Minnesota statute regarding to the health and safety of prisoners? And it would it additionally be true there's no case in Minnesota that's identified the habeas statute applies to statutory violation?
Well, there are two cases that say it does, and we've cited them in the brief. I think it's at page 31. I would have to, I can take a quick look. But there are two cases that, at least two, that say, by this court, that say statutory violations. All right. I've got it now, I think. And the cases are, one of them is Rude, R-U-D v. Fabian, and the other is Lloyd v. Fabian. Lloyd v. Fabian says, the scope of inquiry in habeas corpus proceedings is limited to constitutional issues, jurisdictional challenges, claims that confinement constitutes cruel and unusual punishment, and claims that confinement violates applicable standards, statutes. And that language is repeated in also the Rude case.
Let's assume for the moment that we or the district court would recognize a statutory claim challenging conditions of confinement. And that perhaps is different from statutory claims challenging duration of imprisonment. But if we were to recognize in general the viability of a statutory claim concerning conditions of confinement, Where is your argument? I mean, I don't see, I mean, you cited the statutes both in the petition and in your opening memo in the district court, and then the respondent commissioner and the department came back with a lot of evidentiary materials as well as arguments. And then in your reply memorandum to the district court, I don't believe that you cited any statutes at that stage of the proceeding. So it's hard to criticize the district court perhaps for not addressing your statutory claims because you didn't argue them in your reply brief to the district court. And again, on appeal, you cite the statutes. I don't see a well-developed argument applying those statutes to the evidentiary record to convince us that there was or is a statutory violation. I know that's a compound question, but I'm trying to give you, right, you know, the whole picture rather than asking it in small pieces.
Right. Well, first of all, it is in the petition. Second,
citations to statutes are in the petition. But as I read the petition, it says this statute provides, quote, stop. It doesn't. You don't explain why or how that statute has been violated or was being violated.
Well, I think we do. It says the whole tenor of the petition is that they have a duty to protect us, the duty to protect the petitioners. That duty arises under various sources, one of which is statutory. And then the argument is that they are not protecting the prisoners. And the court itself recognized the duty in its April 29 order to show cause. So, I mean, I believe our reply says the court has already recognized the duty, and we quote the language of the order. So
I believe your reply memo to the district court, I think, was your opportunity to argue for a statutory violation based on a more complete record. Obviously, you put in a lot of evidentiary materials with your petition and your opening memo, but then there were more evidentiary materials. It just seems like your arguments to the district court shied away from arguing for statutory violations.
Well, I think that's because the court had already recognized that there was the duty. And the entire tenor of the reply is that there is substantial evidence that they are violating the duty. I mean, the duty.
Well, can I ask you, because sure. What facts do you depend on to show a deliberate indifference?
The fact
by DOC, because I, as I understand the respondent's argument, it's that I don't think they're disputing they've got a duty. But what they're indicating is that your claim is basically you want the court or you want to tell them how to do that duty. And so how do we analyze this? I mean, you do admit that you have to show deliberate indifference, correct?
Well, that is no, that's a disputed issue. We
okay.
dispute that.
Okay. Then what do you think you have to show in order to get rid of habeas corpus?
A violation of a duty of a legal duty. That's what I think we have to show. And the legal duty here is it's under common law. U.S. Supreme Court has said it several times, the duty to keep prisoners safe. That is, we have to show that they're violating that duty.
And but what is there that supports a deliberate? I mean, all right. I don't know that you answered my question, though. What is it that supports a deliberate indifference if we decide that you do have to show that?
Okay. Number one, they knew there's a threat to life and permanent damage to health. They know that. Number two, they know what they should be doing to protect prisoners from that threat. Number three, the evidence in all our declaration shows that they're not doing it. That's the disputed issue of fact that requires the evidentiary hearing, the trial under the statute 546.12.
Can you be more specific about what the commissioner department should have done or should be doing that they're not doing?
Not enforcing social distancing, not enforcing the wearing of masks, not doing regular testing, not providing satisfactory sanitizing facilities. failing to protect, to identify and protect those most vulnerable and susceptible to COVID-19 because of age or pre-existing condition. Those are all disputed issues of fact. Our declaration show that they weren't doing it. That's why we need the hearing.
Which statutes or which statutory duties are not being complied with? I mean, can you cite to the statutes that are being violated, please?
Yeah, I can. It's Minnesota statutes section 241.021 subdivision 1, which requires the. Let me give you the exact language.
I'm familiar with all the statutes you've cited previously. I'm just wondering which one specifically. I mean, what's your best argument for a violation of a statute?
It's 241.021 subdivision 1, which requires the commissioner to establish rules for security, safety, health, and treatment of prisoners.
And so, and is it undisputed that they have not promulgated those rules?
Well, that they haven't, they may have promulgated them, but they haven't enforced them.
Mr. Shulman, can I just inquire, assuming that the statute can be the basis and or assuming the duty is the standard, although I didn't see any specific case law identifying anything other than willful indifference, how is it that if the petitioners themselves have not alleged they've even contracted the virus, much less contracted and suffered illness from it, be a basis under the habeas corpus to be released?
I see my time has expired, if I may answer the question.
Please do.
Okay. Well, first of all, Mr. Foster has alleged that he believed he had COVID and they refused to test him. But second, you can't, and this is, I think, one of the DOC's arguments, you can't require people to get COVID before they have a cause of action to keep them, that the DOC has to protect, has a duty to protect them. I mean, they are living under the life-threatening, the danger of this disease, and they have a right to be protected from it. So they don't need to contract it before they have a right to sue for a failure to protect them. That's my answer.
Am I correct in assuming that Mr. Sanborn is still at the Moose Lake facility?
So far as I, yes, yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Shulman. It appears there are no more questions for you at this time, but I suspect there may be more during your rebuttal argument. Thank you. Respondents counsel, you may please identify yourself and begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Steve Forrest. I'm an assistant attorney general here on behalf of the Minnesota Department of Corrections. As the court noted, it has before it a very extensive factual record related to the DOC's pandemic response, but the legal issue in this matter is actually relatively simple, and that's whether appellants set forth a prima facie case for habeas or mandamus relief. Regarding habeas, appellant's habeas petition seeks the most extraordinary form of relief available to an incarcerated individual under Minnesota law, and that is to effectively overturn or supersede the criminal sentencing court's orders committing them to prison. The burden to achieve this extraordinary remedy is understandably high. To be released from prison, Minnesota statute requires that appellants demonstrate the illegality of their detention, and it is not enough to merely allege that the DOC is doing something wrong, as habeas does not remedy all wrongs, but rather only wrongs that result in unlawful detention or restraint. Under Minnesota law, to be released from prison, appellants must demonstrate that the DOC's pandemic response rendered their conditions of confinement unlawful. And for their conditions of confinement to be unlawful under Minnesota law, they have to be cruel and unusual. And to be cruel and unusual, appellants must demonstrate that the DOC was deliberately indifferent in its pandemic response.
And now, how do you respond to the argument that they did show that? That there's no dispute that there's a pandemic, there's no dispute it's highly contagious, they knew all this, and yet they didn't do what the CDC had required or had suggested they do in fighting this pandemic.
Well, Your Honor,
and
I think
so that shows, and I think, and that shows an indifference.
Well, there's a couple of responses to that. One is just the extraordinarily high bar that we're talking about here, the standard that they have to show, that and what they've alleged hasn't raised to that. But two, I would.
How much do they have to show of practical, indifference? Have to make a prima facie showing in order to get an evidentiary hearing?
Yes.
And why haven't they done that?
They haven't made a prima facie showing because in order to do that under the Minnesota Supreme Court's precedent in the Cole case, they have to show one, facts that would amount to cruel and unusual punishment under that very high standard outlined in federal law, two, the time and place that that cruel and unusual punishment occurred, specific in this case to Appellant Foster and Sanborn. Three, the identity of the persons responsible for it. Again, this is still the elements of the Cole case, and not appellants concede that they're not actually taking issue with the DOC's pandemic response, but rather the implementation of that response by unidentified insubordinate DOC staff who are not following clear DOC mandates. So they need to identify the person or persons responsible for it to state a prima facie case. And then finally, Cole states in order to have a prima facie case, you need to not only have those things, but you must show that the treatment occurred at a time and place and under circumstances giving rise to an inference that cruel and unusual punishment will be continued or repeated in the future. And the allegations that are alleged in condition or in conjunction with the concessions that they make simply don't rise to that that high burden that they have to show.
Mr. Forrest, isn't that you argued a bit ago that they're seeking release? That's, I think you suggested, that's the only thing that they could recover in a habeas action is release from prison. I mean, isn't it conceivable or possible that a district court could order relief other than release in a habeas action?
Certainly, habeas and Chapter 589 discuss throughout the chapter unlawful confinement or restraint. Notably, in the petition, though, they're not identifying any type of restraint that the COVID-19 pandemic, the DOC's COVID-19 pandemic response is subjecting them to. And they're explicitly asking for release from prison. That's what the petition asked for, and that's what the DOC responded to. But in theory, yes, had they somehow articulated a restraint, habeas could be a remedy for that. But ultimately, no matter what the standard of habeas is, it has to relate in order for Chapter 589 to make sense. Whatever the thing is that they're alleging the DOC failed to do, ultimately it has to result in Appellant Sanborn or Appellant Foster's unlawful detention or restraint to be available in habeas.
And you would agree that the Cole case allows a habeas action to challenge conditions of confinement, correct?
That's correct. Yes. Habeas, the DOC is not arguing that to the extent that appellants could show that, for instance, Warden Boland knew about their specific plight and was deliberately indifferent to their needs, that they would not have a remedy in habeas. Habeas would be an appropriate and adequate remedy at law, which is why, of course, we make that argument with respect to the mandamus claim and why that's inappropriate. But yes, that would be the appropriate form of relief. We just think that they have failed to satisfy this burden.
And would you agree that Crosby leaves open the question whether in a habeas action challenging conditions of confinement, a petitioner could obtain relief based upon a statutory right?
That is unclear to me in resulting or in reviewing the case law. However,
my question is whether Crosby leaves that question open.
I think that that's a fair characterization, Your Honor. However, I would just go back to my previous point that it still has to be some type of violation that results in unlawful detention or restraint.
Or unlawful conditions of confinement.
Sure, yes, that would rendering their conditions of confinement unlawful, yes.
How do you respond to the petitioner's argument that they do not have to show necessarily deliberate indifference?
Your Honor, I as the court noted, I think the DOC and we did, you know, we fairly interpreted their claim as they raised it. If it's not a conditions of confinement claim, it's difficult to know, as the court was trying to flesh out a little bit more, exactly what type of claim appellants are raising. If the if it's not, if they're not entitled to release from prison by virtue of their conditions of confinement being unconstitutional, then what does in fact entitle them to release from prison? And I think that appellants have failed to state what exactly that could be, and appear to be seeking to expand the nature of habeas to include any number of things that wouldn't necessarily go to their unlawful detention.
Would you agree, Mr. Forrest, that if, as the appellant argues, that the statutory violation, and as our court in Lloyd and the Kelsey case referenced, that applies, and they've identified a statute and must only present a prima facie basis, isn't it true that generally, under, regardless of the standard, willful indifference or otherwise, wouldn't generally a district court be confined in a prima facie basis to simply listen to the allegations as opposed to the responses to it, which the court here appeared to rely heavily on the responses as presented by the respondent?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I think there's two things to say to that. Neither of those two cases involved conditions of confinement. Both of those cases involved issues related to sentencing. And we do have Supreme Court precedent that's cited by the DOC related specifically to conditions of confinement that provide guidance as to how this court should analyze it and what a prima facie case is in that specific context. But the other answer to your question, not to sound like a broken record here, would be, you know, okay, well, if there is this statutory violation, how does that violation, well, what is it first, I guess would be the first question. And then the second question would be, how does that violation result in your unlawful incarceration? Because if it doesn't, habeas isn't the remedy available, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there's not a remedy available in the law. It just means that there's not a remedy available in habeas.
Is it, just to clarify, my understanding of appellant's argument is that through that case law and referencing statute, Minnesota has liberalized the statute through common law, essentially, such that it is not limited to a release. I understand you're disagreeing with that, even if we take into account statutory. Am I understanding you correctly?
Yes, I think that that's a misinterpretation of the case law, and this court should look to the case law that directly relates to conditions of confinement claims, Your Honor.
I thought just a few minutes ago you agreed with me that it's conceivable that a district court could issue relief concerning conditions of confinement, could issue relief short of release.
Yes. Yeah, okay.
I understood your answer to Judge Sleater's question to be inconsistent with your answer to my previous question. Perhaps not.
I'm sorry if I misinterpreted the question.
Could be my fault.
Okay. So with the time I have remaining, I can discuss mandamus unless the court has any other questions regarding habeas. Regarding mandamus like habeas.
Could I stop you? Because why isn't counsel entitled to a evidentiary hearing with regard? I mean, it seemed like there's a lot of disputed facts here as to whether the duty was met by the DOC.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I think that the issue of the duty, I think, pertains to the mandamus claim. And we've said that they're not entitled to, or the DOC has said that they're not entitled to an evidentiary hearing based on that, because it's not a clear ministerial duty. Although there may be a duty, it's not a duty that's enforceable in mandamus.
Why not with regard to deliberate indifference, whether there's a deliberate indifference or not?
As we stated in the briefs, here appellants seem to be conflating their two claims. They appear to be saying that if there is some sort of an abstract duty, that this duty is enforceable it can be enforceable in habeas. That's inconsistent for a couple of different reasons. One, mandamus, of course, you know, precludes if you have an adequate remedy at law. But two, for all the reasons that I discussed earlier, if that was the case and there was a duty, how would the failure to fulfill that duty result in your unlawful incarceration. And in order to get to the next step, you have to find that that failure of duty resulted in, you know, was cruel and unusual, and in turn, deliberate indifference to give rise to appropriate habeas claim in order to state a prima facie case for habeas. Is that responsive?
That's fine. Mr. Forrest, would you agree that a habeas petitioner can plead in the alternative, may select from various legal theories, you know, could rely upon the U.S. Constitution, could rely on the Minnesota Constitution, could perhaps rely on any Minnesota statute he wishes to rely on if the Supreme Court permits habeas relief for a statutory violation? In other words, there's nothing necessarily that confines a petitioner to the federal cruel and unusual punishment standard.
I want to make sure I'm understanding your question, but certainly the Minnesota Constitution does make a distinction, or there has been found to provide additional protections, and there's case law on that, particularly in the context of sentencing, where you could find that a sentence is not cruel, but is in fact unusual. But there's been no such distinction in related to conditions of confinement claims. And in fact, the Cole case that's we're relying on, there was both claims brought in that particular case. It was a Minnesota claim and a federal claim, and the Supreme Court didn't make a distinction there. And there's no case law that we're aware of that make such a distinction on a conditions of confinement claim specifically. But you're right, and the other part of your question is, can they argue in the alternative? Certainly they can, but from a legal perspective, the DOC is arguing that habeas is an adequate remedy at law. We're just saying that they haven't stated a prima facie case for habeas, but obviously, as we articulated earlier, to the extent that they did, that would certainly be an adequate remedy of law precluding them from mandamus, as would any number of actions, for instance, a civil rights action. They were not here on a civil rights action on appeal of a TRO. That would be another adequate remedy at law that would preclude mandamus, which is this special proceeding meant only for clear ministerial duties under the law. With my limited time remaining, if there are no other questions, we just ask that the court affirm the district court's denial of the habeas and mandamus petitions. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Forrest. If I may make one friendly suggestion, the flags behind you should be reversed in order. The American flag should always be on its own right side. So for your next argument, That's my suggestion.
Certainly, Your Honor, I will do that.
If Judge Harton were on this panel, he would have said that at the beginning of your argument. So I'm, in a sense, I'm carrying forward Judge Harton's careful attention to the position of flags. Thank you, Mr. Forrest. Mr. Shulman, you have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Just a few points. Number one, I just want to make clear that this case is not about a wholesale release of prisoners through habeas relief. The habeas class, members of the class would be or are alleged to be inmates who have less than 6 months to serve, whose release would be consistent with not endanger public safety, and would have a place to stay where they could satisfactorily social distance. So that is the class for which we ask relief.
But you're agreeing with Mr. Forrest that the relief you seek on behalf of your client or clients is release, nothing short of release?
Well, the petition itself said, of course, as the standard boilerplate, whatever other relief is just and permitted by law. So that is open in the petition. Second thing.
Okay, may I also, you referred to a class. There's been no class certification. Correct.
Correct.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Shulman, why, I mean, let's talk about the mandamus action. Why go that route? I mean, couldn't you have just brought a civil rights action or just brought a motion for an injunction and achieved the same thing? I mean, why the mandamus route?
Because it's available, number one, and because it is fast and it should be convenient. And that was the second thing I was going to respond to, which is the claim that we have an adequate remedy at law. Both of the, well, Judge Byers expressly found in issuing the order to show cause that we did not have an adequate remedy at law, essentially because of the urgency of and the speed with which COVID can spread through a prison and the life.
Can't you get a TRO? I mean, if you have such a strong case, I mean, why? And you can have that converted to a permanent injunction.
We could, but that's not a remedy at all.
So. I mean, you'll admit that the writ of mandamus is an extraordinary remedy, isn't it?
That's right. Yes, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Yes, I concede that. And this is an extraordinary pandemic. In fact, all of us are old enough not to have experienced anything similar in our lifetimes. I know mine is probably longer than anyone else's here.
Mr. Shulman, to follow up with that, obviously the remedy you sought, at least the primary one here, is the habeas, which the court had, by the time it got to the mandamus, had addressed that. Wouldn't it have required your client to present to the court why, for instance, what Judge Hooten raised, a TRO, which no one would doubt would be the fastest remedy, would be available, and or if you don't have a successful remedy in habeas, you have no remedy. That would seem to end the mandamus discussion, which is the way the trial court reviewed it.
Well, when you say primary remedy, I would say the remedies we sought are co-equal. The habeas class is obviously smaller than the mandamus class, which is all prisoners. And the mandamus claim is to order the court to compel, basically to have the court issue an order that the DOC must perform its duty to keep prisoners safe. If I can add one more thing, counsel raised the requirement that we had to show or establish an inference that this would continue into the future. I think that is the importance of the motion to take judicial notice. The court bought wholesale, and I'm quoting, although the DOC website does not show the number of people now isolated or quarantined, the statistics indicate containment of the virus. That at pages 19-20 of the addendum. There is nothing less true than the virus was contained at Moose Lake. We have now gone from since that order on on July 13, there are now, and this is, I looked at the DOC website this morning, there are now 189 cases at Moose Lake. There are in the system since the court's July 13 order, there have been an additional 3,372 cases of COVID throughout the Minnesota prison system, where the DOC is supposed to be protecting prisoners.
But aren't we a reviewing court? So this is not what the judge had at the time of this ruling, right? So it wouldn't be quite fair to the court, would it, if we were to add on all this information?
Yes, but entitled to take judicial notice. It is important in showing that the court should have had an evidentiary hearing. And, you know, justice is blind. Courts don't have to be. And this evidence would be admissible in an evidentiary hearing if it went back.
Could I ask you this? I mean, is it okay, Presiding Judge Johnson? All right, thank you. In that, and I just lost it now, but the fact that you've asked for a writ of mandamus, that's usually for the exercise of a clear legal duty, and it involves a ministerial act. in this case, in that we have all these issues regarding COVID and what you need to do and how you need to do it, when you wear a mask, when you don't wear a mask, you know, do you wear it? I mean, you can't wear a mask in the shower. You can't wear it in the lunchroom. And I mean, there's so many discretionary ways in which you can enforce the CDC guidelines, which, by the way, keep changing. I mean, how could the writ of mandamus be used for something that's so fluid and involves such discretion? I guess that's my question.
The answer to the question is contained in the Cruz Guzman case in the Minnesota Supreme Court. Courts are able to determine whether there is a duty, in this case, there is a duty to keep prisoners safe. They can determine whether there is a duty, they can determine whether it's been violated, and they can order compliance. Now, without getting into the details of compliance, and of course, in the Cruz Guzman case, that is basically involves providing an education to at least 60,000 students in the Twin Cities. So yes, there are all kinds of discretionary parts of that, but there is a duty that has to be performed. And second, there are certain things that can be done and that cannot be done, that it would be clear. For instance, if the DOC said there will be no social distancing, there will be no wearing of masks, a court would have, those are in, but the district court asked for the, in the order to show cause on the mandamus said, tell us what you're going to do about social distancing, tell us what you're going to do about testing. So there are things that will enable a court to know whether the duty is in fact being performed. Similarly, if they said that every inmate had to drink a cup of bleach every night as part of their plan to protect, the court would be able to know that that's forbidden.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask a question or two about your request for an evidentiary hearing. There's a lot of evidence in the record right now from both parties. I'm curious what you would do at an evidentiary hearing. I mean, there seems no need to call those witnesses whom already have provided declarations and affidavits unless you wish do you wish to challenge the credibility of respondents' witnesses? And if so, which ones? Do you wish to introduce additional evidence? I mean, why is the evidentiary record right now insufficient to resolve the claims?
Because we have a contradiction in the facts. I can't cross-examine a declaration.
What are the disputed facts? Are there particular historical facts or objective facts that are being disputed, or is it simply sort of the ultimate facts or the overall determination?
No, there are very particular facts, whether they are in effect, whether they actually are social distancing at the Moose Lake prison, whether they are enforcing the wearing of masks, whether they are testing inmates in a regular manner and when they should be testing them, whether they have provided appropriate sanitizing facilities and supplies to the inmates, whether they have in fact identified and adequately protected those most vulnerable to COVID-19 because of age or pre-existing conditions. So I mean, there are a plethora of facts, and also, if they know what they're doing, why are there now 100 more cases at Moose Lake? You know, what is going on in the system? Are they chasing this disease?
I'm not sure. In light of the fact that we are probably at the peak right now throughout the nation of COVID, I'm not sure that shows too much. I mean, in light of what's going on, it seems like we're not doing well anywhere. It seems like
that may, well, I don't know if it's everywhere, but I think it's certainly worth exploring. These are people that cannot protect themselves from this disease because of the conditions in which they're confined. And they are among the most vulnerable.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shulman. Thank you, Mr. Forrest. The case was well argued both in writing and orally. The court will take the matter under submission and will issue its written opinion within 90 days.